great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at organ donations on the program today. Whether you're looking to donate an organ or organs, or maybe you're on the waiting list to receive one, maybe you want to know a bit more about it, you're going to want to hear what our guests have to say today. Dr. Toby Campbell is one of our guests. He's the chief of palliative care for UW Health, a medical oncologist for UW Health's Carbone Cancer Center, and a professor of oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Toby Campbell, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you, Larry.
Great to have you with us. Also great to have with us Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, transplant surgeon for UW Health and medical director of UW Organ and Tissue Donation, also an associate professor of surgery at the UW School of Medicine. Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Larry, for having us.
And as you listen to our experts talk, I hope you'll join our conversation. Have you signed up for to become an organ donor? Maybe you're waiting for one. I hope you'll join in with your questions about the process. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Maybe Dr. Neidlinger, we can start with you. How important is it to have people willing to donate organs?
Well, Larry, I think this is a great question. So currently there are more than 100,000 people on the waiting list for an organ in the United States. And for the folks who are on that list, they've exhausted their options. So they have end-stage organ failure. I will say the majority of them have kidney failure. Probably 80% of the waiting list is in kidney failure. And for them, the really only option they have at continuing a life that, is sort of manageable for them to live and not tied to dialysis as a kidney transplant. So for those folks, it's really important that people consider donating an organ at the end of life.
Yeah. How does have numbers? I can recall some years back reading that Wisconsin was pretty good compared to other states, but still had a long way to go for improvement, Dr. Campbell.
Well, and I think Dr. Neidlinger is good to comment on this, especially as the director of the Organ and Tissue Donation Program. But, you know, I would just say, Larry, that you're absolutely right that this is an important topic for people to think about. And I hope today's conversation will prompt people to think about that. How do they feel about this idea of organ donation?
Yeah, and it's definitely true that in Wisconsin, you know, it's several thousand people on the waiting list. And this is a state that has been very generous toward organ donation for legislative and I think cultural reasons. There, more than 60% of Wisconsin drivers have signed up to be organ donors, which is favorable. But despite that, there's really, frankly, a shortage of donors. So the list continues to grow at a rate that is quicker than we can transplant people. And the biggest limiting factor is availability of organs. So there's still quite a few people who have the opportunity to donate, and we just aren't reaching those folks.
I read somewhere that one organ donor can help more than 75 people.
That's true, too. So one potential donor typically can donate, in terms of their solid organs, things like lungs, hearts, kidneys. People can donate up to 8 organs. And then additionally, people donate tissues. These are things like corneas, ligaments for, you know, knee replacements or ACL reconstructions, skin for burn victims or cancer reconstruction victims. So in addition to donating solid organs, people can donate tissues to, as you said, up to 75 people. So it's really an incredible gift that people have the opportunity to do.
Yeah. And I may talk about it later, but I've received two, a bone marrow and a cornea from two different people. So that's been, I'll tell you, there's nobody who feels more close to those folks anonymously contributed that than I am, for sure. It's a humbling experience to have that, you feel very, very grateful.
Life-altering.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I received a cornea transplant, for example, from a person, I don't know who it was, but a woman from northern Wisconsin. And you can look and see that I'm looking at three computers here, and there's one split screen. And so I definitely need that cornea. And so, and a lot of people are in much worse condition than I. But I imagine, you know, you've dealt a lot, Dr. Campbell, with transplant patients, donor families. How difficult are those conversations you have with potential donors?
Well, talking to a donor family, I would say, is one of the most unusual and extraordinary conversations in all of medicine. And it's a truly unique and one-off conversation, Larry, because when you're talking to someone about surgery, in every other instance, the intent of that surgery is to help the person who's receiving the surgery. Now, it may not work, but the intent is to help that person. This is the only surgery like it in all of medicine where the intent is actually to help someone else. So the organ donation surgery, because it occurs in a very small eligible population, right? Dr. Neidlinger can speak to this, but you have to sort of, in a weird way, you have to sort of die in the right way to be an organ donor. And that turns out to be a pretty rare opportunity, which is one of the reasons why, you know, 60% of people have signed up to be organ donors, but very few organs actually become available because people die in ways that are not conducive to organ donation. Mm-hmm. But to have that conversation, it's done by experts, organ request specialists, people who have trained to navigate these really, really difficult conversations. I mean, imagine it. You're going to meet with a family on their worst day. They're in an ICU. They are literally in their worst day, a day that they never imagined would happen. And this is the circumstances in which you meet this family and have to walk them through this potential possibility to assess whether or not their loved one would be interested or not. And it's an amazing and a really difficult conversation.
Is it an easier conversation when the person has in advance said that they wish to be and filled out whatever needs to be done?
This is perhaps the takeaway message for me is I hope that this we made a podcast called Extraordinary Conversations, and this conversation that we're having with you today stimulates people's desire and willingness to have that conversation with their loved ones. Those people in your life who, if something catastrophic happened to you and you had some terrible brain injury, those people who would speak for you on your behalf, I think you want to let them know how you feel about things like organ donation. Because, yes, I've met with families who have no idea what their loved one would think, and families who know what their loved one would think, regardless of which way, right? Yes, organ, no organ, doesn't matter. Knowing when you have to speak for someone, what they would say is such a comfort to those families in that terrible time that it's a tremendous gift you're giving to your loved ones.
Yeah. Well, what kinds of concerns would they have?
Well, I think some of the most common concerns relate to body integrity. Some people feel really strongly about their body staying whole as it dies and goes on, whether that be religious or cultural reasons. I think body integrity is one of the most common reasons people mention not wanting to be an organ donor.
Yeah. I was thinking about this past year, in fact, just a few weeks ago, I lost my second brother. So I lost both my brothers this past year, and neither one of them would have been eligible due to the circumstances of, you know, themselves to be organ donors, even though I think they both had that seal on their driver's license. Mm-hmm. But I sort of flashed on that when you were talking about the fact that a lot of people might sign up but aren't eligible. In the end, they're not eligible anyway.
Maybe I could say a little about that. I think following up on what Dr. Campbell said, in order to donate your organs, your solid organs, you have to essentially die in a hospital. So a lot of people, that's just not the case. I mean, by their own choice, I think some people are in hospice or choose to die at home. Some people, you know, suffer some sort of event on the freeway or in the fields and never make it to a hospital. So for those folks, they're not eligible to donate organs because to donate an organ, your organ has to be getting blood and oxygen essentially the time up till it's recovered. So I think that alone limits a lot of potential donors from being able to donate organs. Now, you can still donate tissues, the things we talked about earlier, so ligaments, heart valves, corneas, generally within about 24 hours of your death. But for organs, it's a really unique group, so it limits the number of people who can donate. And then I think additionally, maybe what you're bringing up is we have to be careful about the potential to transmit something to recipients. So if someone's cause of death had to do with something that could be spread, to a person getting an organ, then we have to be wary of that. So there are certain infections or cancers that would limit someone. But something that I hear a lot that I think is important to clear up is a lot of people think that they are too old or too sick to donate their organs.
I hear that
a lot.
Given my age, I was.
We have organ donors that are, donating livers well into their 80s. I think we've even had organ donors over 90 now. So I think age in itself is not necessarily a rule out. And a lot of people will say things to us like, I can't donate because I once had hepatitis C or because of my habits, because I smoked or I drink, these types of things. And for organ donors, we have organ donors that are newborn infants all the way into their 90s. And we have people that have high blood pressure and diabetes and all sorts of other additional illnesses. I think it's important for people to know that you can, impact and save the life of another regardless of your health condition and a lot of situations that are surprising to people.
Hmm. Ryan Fond du Lac has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Roy.
Good morning. I'd just like to say that part of my questions were already answered in my comments, but I'm an attorney. I've done literally hundreds of probably 500 advanced care documents in my practice, and we always cover the issue of organ donations. And I just thought I'd mention some of the reasons that I get from people for not wanting to be an organ donor. One of them you've already hit upon, which was I'm too old. They're not going to want my organs. Another one is that I've been sick and they're not going to want my organs. The last one, which is pretty strange, but I've heard it on a number of occasions, probably more than I'd like to, is that if I am an organ donor, the doctors aren't going to do everything they can to save me because there is a lot of money in organ transplants. So I guess I will just leave that comment where it is and you can address whatever you'd like to out of that.
Absolutely.
Usually, when I hear one of the other earlier objections, I explain that where organs may be an issue if you've been sick or had some other problems, tissue like skin particularly is something that as a universal, it's a universal donation. So at any rate, I'll leave that for your
right.
panel to discuss. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Campbell, we'll turn to you for first.
Thank you for that, Roy. I think this is a really important, and let me try to address it by saying that I'm an oncologist and a palliative care doctor. I'm not actually involved in organ donation or in transplantation. And I was primarily interested in that conversation that we talked about because I'm a communications researcher and communications scientist. So I was interested in that extraordinary conversation. And that turned into this podcast, Extraordinary Conversations Podcast. But we heard, and so I came to this with a degree of skepticism, to be perfectly honest with all of you, about organ donation. Because when I had met people who were involved in this, it was mostly because they had not been able to donate and they were dying and these things were happening. But what I came to realize in interviewing people like Dr. Neidlinger is that there is an incredibly deep commitment to providing the highest quality care to everyone involved in this process, to the donor families, to the donors themselves, and of course to the recipients. I was incredibly impressed with the methodical and thorough nature with which people approach donors and donor families. And it's important for people to realize that ethically, and I think technically, these teams are kept separate. The donation side and the transplant side are kept separate so that there aren't these, I suppose, secondary gain or coercive attitudes towards these two things, because these two teams really operate separately and independently. And so I would want to reassure people that on the doctor side, people in the ICU who are taking care of someone, their entire mission is about providing the highest quality care that they can. And if someone is able to survive an illness or an injury, then that's what they're going for. In that moment when it is realized that that can't happen and that person is an organ, potential organ donor, then those conversations take place, and that's separate from transplant. And I think that's really important, because I perceived absolutely no conflict over that particular issue.
Yeah.
And when you were taking care of patients, I mean, as a physician in the emergency department, were you ever aware? Did you even know if they were on the donor registry? That's not typically a thing as physicians that is even known until, as you said, the point of time comes that either the person has died or is close to death.
Correct. Yeah. I don't think you even know. If you're an intensive care doctor or an emergency room doctor and you're taking care of someone, you're taking care of that person, it really only comes up after decisions have been made, when you realize this is not survivable, then this issue comes up. So it's really quite distinct and separate.
Yeah. We have Dale and Stephen's point. We'll get Dale, hang on. We'll get to you in a bit. But we are talking today to Dr. Toby Campbell from UW Health, Chief of Palliative Care for UW Health, Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, who is Associate Professor of Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Medical Director of UW Organ and Tissue Donation. You can join in too, along with Dale and Stephen's point. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about organ donations today with our two guests from UW Health, Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger. Great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to Dale now in Stevens Point. Dale, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
First comment and then a question. The comment is I was fortunate to work in the medical field for in excess of 40 years, including as a physician's assistant working in dermatology. I must say that I, over my career, met many doctors that had graduated from UW-Madison, and without exception, they were really good at what they did. So there's that comment. My question is, in my estate planning, I'm giving my body, once I'm done with it, to medical science, University of Minnesota. But I would prefer, to give it to Wisconsin, University of Madison. Mm-hmm. How do I do that? Who do I contact? How do I go about it?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Campbell, do you want to take that?
For sure. Thanks for that question. So the UW has a body donation program, and I think if you just searched University of Wisconsin body donation program, you would find it. I think the key thing to know is that people who are interested in donating their bodies after death to the UW or honestly to other universities in other states, this is typically a decision that you need to make for yourself while you are of sound mind and while you are alive. It is not generally a decision that your family could make on your behalf after you have died. So I think the key thing is you look it up when your mind is clear and you're able to make that decision and express your preference. So you do it now. And I would search for the UW Body Donation Program.
Dale, there you go. Does that help?
Oh, very much so. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in again, 800-642-1234. Nicole in Shawano emailed to say she's heard that tissues from organs can be stored and used for other purposes, scientific or otherwise, and companies make a lot of money off of this. Apparently, people consent to this when they check that donation box and have no control over what happens to their tissues after they die. Dr. Neidlinger, can you address that?
Well, thanks for the question. I would say, so in my role, I work typically with organ donors. So as we mentioned before, tissue donors can donate within 24 hours of dying. And tissues are treated slightly differently. So the tissues are recovered and then quarantined until the donor can be tested and sort of clear the chart, cleared and clear testing. They're a little more stringent with regard to sort of infections and cancers that may exclude a tissue donor. There are tissue processors that are both for-profit and not-for-profit. And my understanding is that, you know, people have the right to decide, do I want to donate my tissues to one or both? So I believe that, you know, people have the right to exclude if they were to say, I only want to donate tissues to a, you know, this or that entity. I do think it's important, as you mentioned in your own experience, that the tissues can be life-altering and changing, like, just as much as organs. So I think they're a very important gift to give. There are some processors that are for profit, and not that those are a bad thing or sinister in any way, but I think patients have the right to decide what they wish to do with their, you know, parts after they die.
Makes sense. So if somebody dies, let's say there's a car crash or something, and the person hasn't filled something out, is it possible for the husband or wife or remaining family member to make that decision for them?
Yeah, we call that surrogate decision making. So when someone makes a decision on behalf of someone else, and in medicine we do this all the time, we meet with people who are unable to make decisions for themselves. They're too sick, they're in the ICU on a breathing machine, for example. If we feel someone needs an urgent decision and they aren't going to be able to make it for themselves, then we would turn to, in many cases, people have predetermined, as we heard from the lawyer earlier, like in a healthcare power of attorney, someone may have designated who is the person that I want to speak on my behalf. And I would suggest, by the way, to all of the listeners now, that having a healthcare power of attorney is a really important and helpful thing. I have one. I suspect Dr. Neidlinger does. It's an important thing to designate. This is the person that I would want to speak for me if I were ever unable to speak for myself. If you don't have a healthcare power of attorney, we have a process. We go to a spouse first and then adult children. We follow a process, but we want to try to work with your surrogates who can speak on your behalf, even including decisions about organ donation.
Yeah, I was thinking in my own situation, I was medical power of attorney over one of my brothers, and so I had to make some decisions. And those are, by the way, are difficult decisions to make if, you have a brother on a breathing tube and has a DNR, do not resuscitate order, and they say, well, do you want to go ahead with that? Do not, it's a very difficult situation for the person who's in that position. I can tell you that based on my own experience.
I don't think there are situations that are more difficult, to be honest. You're making life and death huge decisions on behalf of someone else who you love and care about. You are tired and exhausted. You're probably hungry. You're trying to make these decisions. In my world as a palliative care clinician, we are often working with families who are sitting in that very uncomfortable place and trying to help them navigate these difficult decisions in a way that respects the person for whom we're trying to make decisions for. But it can't really be much tougher, Larry.
No, I can tell you that for sure. And you think about it after the fact for a long, well, I'm still thinking about that, all these months later. We had a couple of emails. They relate to things we've kind of covered. Anne in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, wondering about donating her body for study at university. And I That can certainly, again, where do you go for?
You would search for the UW Body Donation Program. That would be the best way to go about that particular request.
And Tom, again, had wanted to know, and this bears repeating, I think, if there's an age limit after which person's organs cannot be donated, Dr. Neidlinger?
No age limit. I mean, we've had organ donors older than 90, so no age limit.
No age limit. You, Dr. Neidlinger, you perform organ procurement surgery, I guess is the way that, yep. The nice way to put it.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Explain that.
So an organ procurement surgery is only occurring, of course, after someone has died and either they themselves or their surrogates, as we've talked about, has given their authorization for their organs to be donated. But it is a really unique experience. As a transplant surgeon, I was trained to do this, and I got to tell you, like, it's the things that you know, sort of can't unsee, like the whole magnificence of it all. You typically will fly, if it's greater than 100 miles, on a small plane, often in the middle of the night, to the hospital where the donor has died. And you will meet that person's loved ones, their people, and the people that have been with them at the end. And I try to thank them for the gift that they've given. It's always a challenging conversation because, again, like we've said, you're meeting them in the worst day. I mean, yeah. They never anticipated this. And then we really honor donors in a lot of ways. And one of those is by something called an honor walk. So typically when an organ donor is going from the ICU to the operating room where you actually perform the procurement, there's often a line of, you know, hospital employees, nurses and you know, respiratory technicians and physicians that are honoring the person in silence, sort of shoulder to shoulder the whole way to the operating room. And then before we start the procurement, we also do a moment of silence, and we often will offer some reflections that the family has given us about their person, and so that we, you know, sort of pay homage to the fact that this is a person who has given such a tremendous thing. And the operation itself takes us several hours, and it is anatomically an amazing operation, but it's also very profound in that at a certain point during the operation, it becomes, you know, apparent that you're going to remove the organs to save someone else and fill this person's, you know, body with ice. And it's a really incredible and profound experience. And then you bring these organs back in a cooler, and where others have been waiting for perhaps years to receive them. The whole thing is probably the most, you know, it's the biggest privilege of my life to be able to do it, but it's a very profound experience.
On the third episode, I got to join the team on a recovery, got to ride on the small plane, and I can attest that this is an almost unbelievable experience from start to finish. And the energy and enthusiasm and amazing coordination of, I don't even know, 1,000 moving parts in multiple different places, you know, because there are recipients who've been called to the hospital, right? Because the team is going on a recovery mission. So the recipients are on their way to the hospital. Sometimes, Larry, if a liver is going to one place and the kidneys are going to a different place and the lungs are going to a different place, you might have three, four, five, six different recovery teams who are working together in the operating room to recover their organ that's going to their hospital and that organ that's going to that hospital. It is kind of mind-boggling, Larry, the coordination that happens.
Yeah, you guys, and the way you've both described it brings a tear to my eye. I mean, it's really something. Sarah in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I'm so appreciating this conversation between you and your experts. And I am a patient advocate lawyer, and I just wanted to clarify one thing about power of attorneys for healthcare in Wisconsin. I run the Center for Patient Partnerships, and it is essential that people in Wisconsin get a power of attorney for healthcare because there actually is no default decider in Wisconsin. If you don't have one, then your loved ones need to get a guardianship, which can be very expensive and time-consuming. So certainly law in action means that if there's no conflict in the family, that doctors, as was described, often do look to the spouse. But technically, they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be a court process to appoint a guardian.
Sarah, thank you very much for calling. Dr. Campbell?
Well, yes, thank you, Sarah. Thank you for that important clarification, and thank you for your work. I mean, if you all don't know, the Center for Patient Partnerships is an extraordinary organization that I support in any way that I can, and I just think her advice is great.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you very much for your additional comments there. Dr. Neidlinger, you actually specialize in kidney transplants. Why is that? I mean, I think you do others, but why choose that surgery specialty?
I'll tell you, I love doing kidney transplants. I've been doing them now it's been almost 20 years, and it is like an amazing, life-changing operation, and we do them on folks that have typically had quite a bit of waiting time, and they have a life often on dialysis, which is not a great life. So that generally is looking like 3 or 4 times a week for 3 or 4 hours per time, you know, in a chair hooked up to machines. They're unable to travel and do a lot of the things that bring them joy. And when we're able to give them a kidney transplant, the operation takes us, you know, 2-3 hours. And the most amazing thing I've ever seen is that we attach a kidney and then open it up to blood flow. And before we can even hook the urine tube up, often it starts, you know, functioning as a kidney. It's amazing. And every time I've seen it thousands of times now. But every time I'm like, this is a miracle. This is amazing. And a lot of times we'll have, you know, learners, because we're in an academic center. So often we'll have, you know, residents and medical students, and I see the looks on their faces, and I'm like, I still have that look. It is. And the patients, I mean, their life is completely changed, and often they're out of the hospital in, you know, 3-4 days with a whole new lease on life. So I love doing kidney transplants. It's my favorite. And
I can see why.
In the podcast project, I interviewed a number of transplant surgeons, and many of them had not pre-contemplated a career in transplant medicine until a surgery like this that they just happened to walk into when they were a resident, and they saw the kidney making urine, and then they were like, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
It's amazing. And Dr. Campbell, you've mentioned in passing your podcast, maybe explain that a little bit more, because there may be people who, I mean, you were describing, and I assume that was in your podcast, your trip.
Yes, was not a podcaster before this project, but I have always been motivated by really hard conversations. And so I wanted to open up the box a little bit and let people peer into this world of organ donation and transplantation. So I carried my microphones with me for actually 3 or 4 years, and I interviewed around 50 people all throughout this process, and essentially we followed organs from a donor all the way through to recipients. And so it's 6 episodes. You can find it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts. It's called the Extraordinary Conversations Podcast. Our website is extraordinaryconversationspodcast.com, but you can find it on Spotify or Apple or wherever, and you can give it a listen. We interviewed really amazing people. And I think the product that we put together, I'm really proud of, to be honest. It was.
It's terrific. It's terrific. It highlights the stories and does such a good service to the whole enterprise.
And again, the title is?
Extraordinary Conversations Podcast.
Okay. Joel Patnon's our producer today. Joel, would you put that podcast up on, as you're listening, put that podcast link up on our page today. And we'll get that in case people don't forget or they won't, but they in after the fact and want to know where it is. And Joel just sent me a note. Will do. So we'll have that up about 2 hours after the show's over. We'll have that up on the talk at wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date and we'll have that link if you'd like to follow up. And I want to do it myself because I think it sounds extraordinary. Sherry in Elkhorn has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to let someone know that we've gone through the whole process, the honor walk and everything with our 35-year-old son. And we knew that he wanted to donate, so it was not a hard decision for us because we had talked about things, you know, openly for a while. But he was taken right immediately by a stroke, and he did not come out of it. So we knew that he wanted to donate, and that decision was not hard for us to make. And the thing that happened to us, though, was he went, you know, into the surgery, and he was on a respirator, and we thought he was dying, and so did the physicians, but he hung on after they pulled the respirator and was still breathing for a while. So there were a lot of the organs they couldn't use because he was no longer on the oxygen. And we were so disappointed.
Yeah.
But there were some, he was able, I believe, to donate his eyes and some tissue, but the major organs were, we were so hoping that, you know, he would live on.
Yeah.
Well, Sherry, if I could say something, Sherry, like one thing I want to say is thank you so much for your and your son's gift. Like, I hopefully you've heard this before, but, you know, as a representative of a lot of recipients, it's not lost on us the magnitude of people's gift. And I think the intention to donate is what matters. So thank you for that. I think that what is being mentioned here is that in order to donate your organs as a deceased donor, you have to have died to take them out. And there are two routes to do that. So about half the donors have died of a neurologic insult, so a brain insult, and they're declared brain dead. And those folks can go to the operating room once they're declared dead in an ICU and have their organs recovered. There's a second category of folks who do not meet the criteria for brain death. So they may be, they often are, obtunded or comatose, very close to death, but they do not meet the very strict criteria for brain death. And in those folks, they go to the operating room and have, as Sherry mentioned, the breathing tube and the respirator removed. And if their heart stops in a certain time period, then we recover their organs for transplant. Now, there is a maximum amount of time that the organs can sustain, you know, being off the breathing tube, because that happens when they get to the operating room. And generally, if the person's heart doesn't stop in a predesignated time period, which is usually a couple of hours, then it renders the organs, unfortunately, unable to be transplanted. And it sounds like perhaps that was the experience that Sherry's family had. I am sorry that that happened. It's very hard to predict, you know, which patients will die after a compassionate extubation. But I do want to say thank you to you and your son and your family for being willing to give the gift, and also that he was able to give tissues, which is a tremendous gift as well.
Sherry, I also want to say thank you. And hearkening back to the earlier question about the integrity of these teams being separate, I think, Sherry, your story actually highlights that the care that we're providing to donors is just for donors, and we want to take the best care of them that we can. And if they are not dying, right, which is to say that their heart didn't stop and they didn't die in a way that was fast enough, if you will, while it's kind of crushing because that was your family's bright spot that you were looking forward to, on the other hand, it sort of highlights that we are, as a medical system, providing the best quality care to that donor that we can until the moment that they die, and then it switches to transplant. So it should, at the same moment as it was crushing for you, it should give hope to those families who worry that people are taking organs, like the earlier caller mentioned. This is a case that sort of highlights that doesn't happen.
Well, and Sherry, as someone who has received a cornea, I can tell you that is very much, I very much appreciate that gift. And so you can take some solace in that for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Melissa, let's go to Melissa in Madison. Melissa, hi.
Hey,
thank
guys.
You for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just curious, like, so I registered as a donor when I was, whatever, 15 and a half or something, when I first got my driver's license at the DMV. I'm no longer 15. I was a little confused about, do I need power of attorney? Like, if I'm registered, is that enough, or do I need to go do other paperwork? Does anyone, and I know you're not attorneys, but just curious if you could clear that up a little bit.
You know, and we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm realizing that I get involved in the conversation, and I forget about breaks that I have to take. Let's take one right now, and we'll come back with an answer, Melissa, so don't worry about that. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at organ donation on the program today with Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger from UW Health. Great to have them with us. Greg in Madison has a question. Let's go to Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Larry. I know this is an organ donation process, and I know that the surgeons, it's expensive to have a surgeon do this, and the transportation of the organ from these locations to the hospitals, and that process is expensive. I'm just wondering, I don't feel great about the question, but does the hospital charge for the organ itself? Or, I mean, it's donated.
Yeah, okay.
And there's an expense to the process.
Yeah, understood, Greg. Dr. Neidlinger?
Yep, I've got an answer to that. I think I can help clarify this. So organs can't be bought or sold, and they're not bought or sold, but there is, as you're describing, expense that goes into the process to work up someone for donation, to do the appropriate testing that you need to do on the organs, to be able to fly and recover the organ and bring it back. There are associated expenses with that. So one thing that I think is important to tell the listeners is that the family will not, the donor nor their family will not incur those additional expenses. So where those expenses do go is that there is an acquisition fee, what it costs to obtain a kidney for transplant, for instance, and that the insurer of the recipient will cover those expenses. So the insurance company is delighted, honestly, to cover the costs to acquire a kidney for transplant because it's a fraction of the cost to maintain someone on dialysis. So the biggest insurer, and I think we don't need to get in the weeds on it, but is Medicare for kidney patients. So the expenses to acquire the organ will be covered by whoever the insurer is of the recipient. And those costs don't go to the family.
Greg, thank you very much for calling. Charles in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Charles.
I do a lot of estate planning with the declaration to healthcare professionals and powers of attorney, and a question often comes up: when is a person in a terminal or persistent vegetative state that they will not recover? Some people say, "What if I come out of a coma after 20 years?" You know, but anyway, I assume the process is declaring someone brain dead is a scientific thing. The other issue is if there's any incentives, anybody. I know if you donate your body for anatomical study, in some places the institution, the university, will come and pick up the body at no charge. They'll use the person's body for anatomical study, and then when they're done, after a semester or two, they will cremate the person at no charge and return their cremains, or even bury them at an unmarked cemetery at Picnic Point in Madison. So I don't know if there's any incentives like that financially for organ donation, too, or not. Thank you.
I'll let Dr. Neidlinger comment about the incentives, but my impression is there are no financial incentives for donation. I think it's important to try to keep that process as clean and as just based on decision-making as possible. The body donation program, my understanding, if someone's body is, for example, being used in an anatomy lab to teach future doctors anatomy, because as that process unfolds, pieces are being removed, right? The liver comes out, the heart comes out as that's being further dissected. There is a cremation process that happens afterwards. Families are given cremains, although I do think that it is a collective cremains, and I think that they make that process pretty clear. And I'm not honestly sure at all if burial happens. I don't, it's hard for me to imagine that it happens on Picnic Point, but I don't know the answer to that.
I have not heard that. I will echo that we can't financially incentivize organ donors. You know, I think it's cleaner to not. There are rules around, you know, directly paying organ donors. So we unfortunately, I mean, or fortunately, cannot pay families or people for their organs. But I think it keeps sort of integrity in the process in that way.
Can you get away with, in terms of being an organ donor, with just that seal on your driver's license?
That's a great question. I think the previous caller, Melissa, had asked that as well. So I don't want to discourage anyone from doing a healthcare power of attorney because they're much more thorough in terms of what you're able to designate. But people are able to designate their desire to donate organs and tissues on the donor registry. So I think that's what was being mentioned earlier. The vast majority of people are doing that at the DMV because the question gets asked directly at the DMV. If you have, you know, signed up at the DMV, it is a legal binding document as long as you are 18 years or older. So I think the previous caller who signed up at 15 and a half, we would still seek their legal surrogate's permission unless the person was after 18 once they died. So you can make decisions about your ability to donate organs on the registry, and you can also do that at heroicdeed.com. But again, a healthcare power of attorney is going to be the best way to make more broad end-of-life decisions for yourself beyond just organ donation.
And I would just add that at the time you make that designation, I would strongly encourage you to talk to the people in your life who love you, who care about you, who would be in a position to make decisions for you if you ever needed someone to speak for you. Let them know that you made that decision. I've met with families who are struggling with this, and the knowledge that their loved ones signed up and then the verbal confirmation that they've signed up and that this was a decision that they made is so helpful to those families in that moment.
Yep. Yeah. Agree.
Thank you, Charles, again. And Paige in Mount Pleasant, we're running out of time, but if you got 30 seconds here maybe to make a comment.
Well, I just wanted to thank all those who actually have made the decision to be organ donors. I've been blessed to have a sister who's now 54. She had her first liver transplant at the age of 6, and at that time it was experimental. And if it wasn't for the fact that so many people were thankless and selfless and willing to give that, I would not have had the blessing of having a sister still with me today.
That's a wonderful comment, Paige. Thank you very much. And it's probably, I hope you receive those kinds of comments through your work, both of you. Dr. Neidlinger?
Yes, Paige, thank you so much for that comment. I couldn't agree more. I think the fact that people on the worst day that they never imagined coming decide to say yes to helping out another person is to me evidence that the world is still a great place, honestly. People, it matters to people to leave a legacy, and altruism matters. And I agree with you. To all of the listeners out there who are on the donor registry or to donor families, some have called in today who have agreed to give this gift. I just want to personally also thank all of those folks and say that it's not lost on us as transplant surgeons, the magnitude of the gift that is.
And I would just close by saying it's easy to imagine recipients, just as your sister is, that they derive benefit. In my interviews with donor families, people who made that decision on behalf of someone else, I was honestly and genuinely surprised in such a heartfelt way that the decision to donate, and they spoke a lot about legacy, for example, but the decision to donate powerfully influenced their grief experience for years to come in a positive way.
And on that note, I want to thank you both for the work you do and for being with us today. Thank you very much, Dr. Toby Campbell and Dr. Nicole Neidlinger, with us today to talk organ transplants from UW Health. Great to have them with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're switching gears, and Jill Nadeau, my executive producer, will be joining us next, right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us on WPR News. You know, every two months, during the course of a year, we bring our book club members together. And you're a book club member, whether you know it or not.
Whether you like it or not.
And we, at the beginning of the year, we like to do an announcement of the books for the new year. And so it's time to reveal our 2026 book club list. And executive producer for the show, Jill Nadeau, in the studio with me to talk about the six books we've chosen and a bit about the authors themselves. And, you know, we'd like to hear from you, too, along the way. What kinds of books have inspired you? What did you think of last year's list? What would you recommend maybe down the road? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And, Joe, why don't you talk about the process we go through to select these books?
Sure, Larry. Thanks so much, and Happy New Year to everybody out there. So what we try to do throughout the year, we have good intentions
of
creating a list of possible candidates. And we look at that list then usually in December. A lot of times we have neglected that and kind of start doing it in October, November. But I try to do that because sometimes we get so many books and so many of them are so good, but we just don't have the time to put them on the air. So we kind of carved out a little bit of a special place to put those and considering that. So we have this list, we get together with our team and we take a look at them and talk about
them.
And
we have
a
criteria.
We do. We want to make sure that there's some kind of connection to Wisconsin or close. So maybe it's from Minnesota or Illinois, but either the author lives here, has lived here. They're talking about Wisconsin.
In the book.
So yeah, that's kind of our criteria. We're looking at novels usually, although some of them are kind of novel-y, but not necessarily novels. So so that's how we kind of look at it and figure it out.
And we, you know, in the course of a year, we'll do 50 books probably, or close to it,
yeah.
How's this different than the other authors that we have for the books?
Well, the idea was that we wanted listeners to read ahead of time, because a lot of times when you talk about a book, no one has really read it or heard about it, especially because a lot of times they're brand new. Mm-hmm. These books have been out for a little while in most cases, and so we want people to read them ahead of the time that we talk to the author. So just as like in a book club, everybody's kind of on the same page, so to speak, and we can get questions from listeners if they've read it and they're wondering about it.
And you, as executive producer and the boss, get to contact the authors.
I do.
How do they react?
They're always so thrilled, Larry. And even though it's an email, I don't usually call because you know how that goes. But I'll email, and you can just tell they're so excited. And I know there are six authors right now. I told them they can't really reveal it to their social media until after we announce it. So I think they're all waiting patiently so they can tell all of their friends, family, and fans that they're going to be on the book club.
Well, let's get to the books.
Yeah.
Our first book is Waltraud, A True Story of Growing Up in Nazi Germany by Tammy Borden. And this one was suggested by a listener, Jim Poson.
That's right. And that happens sometimes.
Yeah. Well, maybe before we get to the book itself, how can folks suggest books or topics for the show?
If you have a book, remember our criteria. So we want some kind of relationship to Wisconsin, Midwest on the outset. Also looking more for a novel, and not super long because we have to read all these, so it takes a while. But just send them in, and also that they're not too old. We don't want them more than 2-3 years old.
Yeah.
It's just a way of narrowing things down. So, then you can just send us an email at talk@wpr.org is our general email. So anytime you want to contact us, please just send something there. Even if we're not on the air, we still look at it. So
What's this, the story about?
Well, this is a really interesting story because the author, Tammy, it's about her mother who was growing up in northern Germany when she was young. This takes place in 1937. And as you know, this was not a great time to be living in Germany for most people. And it's different because it's her viewpoint of what it was like to actually be in Germany at the time and what there was that fear and the you know what was going on with the Nazis and all that. So we've got basically it's a firsthand account through her daughter about what was going on and what it was like.
And I'm thinking of themes here. We've got resilience, we've got resistance, mm-hmm. and of course survival.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear. There's defiance, you know, which. It's hard to do sometimes, especially in those circumstances. So, yeah.
I saw a little note from her that she professionally had helped others write and tell their own stories through various articles and books and blogs, and she says, now it's my turn.
Yeah. And that's really true. And she was smart enough to record some of her mom's stories. So
I spent years doing
that. Yeah, yeah. How many of us have... thought, gee, I wish I had done that.
Oh, man, you got that right. So, mm-hmm. it's Waltraud, A True Story of Growing Up in Nazi Germany by Tammy Borden. And in February.
February 19th. So we try to have the books on the third Thursday of every other month, starting in February. And I'll have those all listed on our webpage after we're done here sometime today. But they're way down at the bottom. But so if you scroll down, you will see those too. So don't think you have to write these down. But that gives you plenty of time to go and get that book. You can rent it from the borrow it from the library. You can go out and buy it, or I think it's probably on ebook too. So,
yeah, well, then February, March, April 16th, we're going to be talking to Quan Berry about her latest book. It's titled The Unveiling. What can you tell us about this novel?
Well, first of all, I've got to say that Quan Berry, or whoever picked out the cover for this book, did a really good job.
Yes.
There's something so sinister about it. It's kind of interesting because this is an iceberg, and usually with an iceberg, most of it's below the water, but with this picture, most of it's above the water. So I haven't had a chance to read this, so I'm not quite sure why, but I'm curious to find out. But basically, here's the story. It's genre bending, okay, from what the description is. It's a literary horror set in Antarctica, and it looks at abandonment, guilt, survival, and it's they're on a cruise. There's a black film scout, and her mission is to photograph potential locations for this big budget movie about Ernest Shackleton's expedition, which was doomed, of course. So, and along the way, she's just finding native wildlife, and then there's some tourists that cause some problems. So, there's a kayaking excursion that goes terribly wrong.
Yes.
As they do.
And they're wound up on an ice floe or something.
It's an island, I believe.
An island, is that it?
I think so.
I tell you, I'm really looking forward. I look forward to all of our books, but I thought this one is going to be, this is different and really cool. The title is The Unveiling.
That's right. And she
Quan Berry's an interesting person, too.
She really is. She's written 8 books of fiction and some poetry, and she won the 2020 ALA Alex Award. And she is a professor of English at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So she won't have too far to go when she comes over and talks to you, Larry.
That's right. We'll have her in person.
Yes.
Well, let's see. Let's take another one. In June, we'll talk about the novel Pigeon Falls, mm-hmm. and the author's Jeff Elzinga, Wisconsin product there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this looks like a really interesting one, too. So it's set during a week in a small town in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, and it takes place with a traveling construction crew and all the challenges that go with this and trying to get this project finished before winter winter arrives. I think we can all deal with that one. We've all
was it
been
wind
there.
Turbines? Or
were... I believe that it is wind turbines. Yes, it is wind turbine builders, and they're kind of out of the way. And there's challenges, of course, and it tests the crew's character, and of course, it threatens to pry the team apart. And there's a pig farmer
involved in it
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So.
So I'm looking forward to talking to Jeff about that book for sure. And here's another Wisconsin professor.
Yeah. Do you have that information, Larry? Because I can't see it for some reason.
He graduated from St. Olaf and Columbia, both degrees from both those places. He was a Foreign Service officer for the U.S. Department of State.
He served in Tunisia
and Malawi, and then here more than 20 years. He was a college instructor and retired in 2018 as an emeritus professor of writing at Lakeland University in Wisconsin.
That's right. So another professor.
With strong Wisconsin ties.
Yeah. So does that mean when you retire, Larry, you're going to write something for us?
I always thought, you know, we've got on the seventh floor of Vilas Hall, there's two elevators. One elevator works, and the other one has never worked. It had to do with running out of money when the building was built. And the elevator, the shaft was there, but they couldn't afford the elevator at the time, as the story goes. And then they were going to wait till the next fiscal year, and they didn't get around to it. And then I think the company had quit making that particular elevator.
We got the shaft, Larry.
So the title of my mystery will be The Seven-Story Shaft.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Yeah. If it's good enough, Larry, I might have you back.
Oh, it's probably going to take about 5 years to write, but
at least.
I'm going to give it a shot. Well, at the end of summer.
Yes, in August.
We have the title of the novel, I believe, Scarred But Not Broken by Olivia Karimi Jones.
Right. And this is a memoir.
It is.
And it's a thinner book. I started reading it and I didn't want to put it down. It was so interesting and such a viewpoint that you don't really get. It actually takes place in Africa, although the author lives in Verona. It's just something that most of us have not ever had to experience, but it's moving. You know, they're talking about resilience and sacrifice and hope, which is, you know, so important in a book like this. And it basically talks about a woman who's thrust into marriage at a really young age, and she's left to raise her daughters alone in brutal, brutal poverty. And the rejection she gets because she is basically a single mom. And it's from her family and his family. And it's deep, it's dark, but there's hope.
And through education and motherhood and personal restoration, I think were the terms. And she is Kenyan American author.
Yes, she is. She was born in poverty. Obviously, this is a memory of hers. She is today a dedicated nurse, which we've had a number of nurses that have written books. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine with their experience that makes it sense. That makes sense for sure. So.
Well, I think it's also the nurses that I've known either personally or I was in the hospital myself, they're caring people and they're insightful. They tend to be, in my experience, caring and insightful. And some of them, as is the case with Olivia Karimi Jones, can put those thoughts and those emotions to words.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's... It's pretty cool. And I'm looking for, I won't be, whoever replaces me will be doing that interview, but I can tell you for sure, I will be listening into that. Hopefully, maybe I'll call in with my own comment.
There you go, Larry. There you go.
In October, we have Janice Falk on to talk about her book, and her book is titled Not Yet Lost. What can the reader find between the covers of that book?
Well, it was interesting because the publisher actually said this is for fans of Kristen Hanna and Jennifer Shiverini. And obviously, we've had Jennifer on a number
of times.
And it's a novel about a Polish immigrant woman who fights against worker oppression in Depression-era Detroit, despite opposition by many, including her husband. So, it's described as gritty, cinematic, and Florence and her best friend are enraged by the poor treatment, the low wages, and they do something about it. It's about the Eastern immigrant struggle, which, of course, the beginning of the century was very, very in the headlines. And there's communism, there's xenophobia, there's secret societies, there's all kind of stuff. And basically, it's like, is our heroine going to resolve her conflicts both inside and outside of the home? So that sounds like it should be really fun, too.
Well, and I liked, I was reading a little report on, or a little biography, very short one, but it mentions her life, and in her first act, she raised a family, she pursued a business career and lived large and wide.
Yes.
And whoever's doing the interviewing, I would start with that large and wide part. Graduated from Michigan and Northwestern, and now in her second act, you can find her kayaking the Great Lakes or pruning lavender plants on her organic farm.
In Door County. Yeah.
She and her husband, Jim, currently live in a home they built by combining a couple of 157-year-old log cabins.
Amazing. Amazing. she will be a wonderful interview, as all of our authors. That was something that a lot of them had in common, is they got such interesting backgrounds that we can not only talk about the book when we talk to them, but also about themselves. So.
And, excuse me, the last book for 2026, for our book club at least, believe me, we'll be interviewing many other authors along the way, but the last book, our December edition selection, is titled Settle Down, and the author is Rit Dietz. What's the theme in Settle Down?
It's all about what is home. When we're going to be doing this in December, so I think that's an important topic when you're thinking about it. And it's about a college kid who's got hypnotic powers, which I'm eager to read about. And he keeps telling himself that there's just got to be more waiting for him when he graduates. He graduates from UW-Madison, I believe. And he wants to get out, as many people do, and he goes to the University of Virginia, majors in history, but he has no idea what he's going to do with it, and he ends up in a catering job, and he's telling Southern folk tales to his coworkers and puts them to sleep, which I thought was interesting. But it's one of these books where it's real, but it's a little surreal, I guess. So that should be a really fun way to close out the question, because then he returns to Madison and he's still, maybe he's going to ask the big question, what is home anyway? So
it's interesting because he, the author, Rit Dietz, he teaches French at the UW-Madison. So here's another professional, a professor tie.
Mm-hmm.
An accomplished songwriter, a musician. He's also a Kentucky colonel and a knight in France's, the country of France's, Order of Academic Palms, which is really, it's a prestigious national order. It was established by Napoleon in 1908, and it recognizes distinguished contributions to French education, culture, and science, and it's awarded to academics or teachers or non-teachers for eminent service.
Yeah, pretty cool. And the Kentucky Colonel title is pretty cool, too. I can't remember exactly what you have to do to get that, but yeah, so Ritt's going to be a very interesting interview also. Yeah, it's all really great books to look forward to.
So how many did we review? It's a large number.
For this one, you mean?
Yeah.
For this, I think we had about 20 maybe on the list, maybe a little less. We kind of winnow them out as we go, too, if they don't quite meet the criteria. And then we have to remember that we still do other books along the way. But these are the ones we picked to have people read along with us.
Yeah, and sometimes some of the other books may wind up on the show, but maybe in another.
Right, right. So maybe we had that author on before, and, you know, we kind of hate to give this opportunity to the same author, but it has nothing to do with their quality of their book. But, we're trying to get as much diverse information and authors that you might not have picked up and read. I'm always so pleasantly surprised when I find out about a book. It's like, I don't think that appeals to me. But then I read it and I'm like, whoa, that was amazing. So that's kind of what we're trying to do.
That is one of the most fun parts of this job for me is, and there are, you know, with 50 books or thereabouts, maybe it's 45, you know,
it depends on the year.
Mm-hmm. To the next. But there are many is the occasion over the years when I have gotten a book and why did the producer or why
or
are we?
Chill.
And then I read the book and it's like, wow. And it's something, and I think to myself, you know what, Mueller, this is something you probably never would have read.
Mm-hmm.
Except, yeah. and that's the exciting thing for me. Here I've read something that I wouldn't have read, and probably there are a lot of other people listening who would have said, well, I'm not going to read that.
Yeah.
But then you listen to the author, and I know it results in a lot of book sales people doing it. Around Christmas time, I interviewed an author. This is some years ago, probably before you even started. And I had such a good time with the author, and I'd had to return the book, I think, for one reason or another, I had to return the book. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to buy one for Christmas. And I went to the university bookstore, and this is like a couple weeks after the show, and I said, do you have a copy of this book? And he said, it is the darndest thing. That book came out. I had numerous copies 6 months ago. We put it out. He said, I don't think we sold maybe one or two. And they all sold in the last 2 weeks. So I was mad. First, I didn't get a copy of the book right away, but I was also happy that we've helped some authors, and we've also helped some listeners find something that's important to them.
Something that's different.
Well, Jill, you've talked long enough.
Thanks, Larry. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you.
It's not the normal way I tell a guest.
I'm his boss.
Yeah. See, I can do it on the air. No, you can't do anything to me now. You have to wait till afterwards. Jill Dadeau with us. Coming up, though, we're gonna have some fun talking about the winter holiday season and talk with Ann Sayre, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, about what the heck's going on in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, the winter holiday season kind of come and gone, but here in Wisconsin, we still have a lot of winter left, and the best way to cope with it is to embrace it, I say. Larry Mealer here. And back to talk about winter events, activities, and destinations is Ann Sayers, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We'll talk about some various efforts to promote winter tourism in the state, as well as places to go and things to do in the cold and snow. And just a quick reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts. But let's talk about embracing winter in Wisconsin. How do you do it? Do you ski or snowshoe or go snowmobiling? Have you persuaded people from out of state to come to Wisconsin in the winter? Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Ann Sayers, Secretary Sayers, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Larry. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I tell you what, Wisconsin's known for its winters. And what is it Wisconsin residents love about winter here and that outsiders need to experience?
I mean, I just love Wisconsin winter, and I think people who have discovered it are also sharing that with others, that they love it too. You know, bring a jacket. You're going to want your jacket. But once you do that, you're going to find all kinds of experiences. So whether you love snow and you want to do those outdoor activities, or you're more of, I think they pronounce it hygge, the art of being cozy indoors, we're really, really good at that. And of course, there's lots of enriching experiences too. Just really interesting culinary and arts, culture, so many museums. If that's more your jam, we have all of that. You're going to have a great time.
You bet we all will. Travel Wisconsin has 4 new short videos, which are really cool, highlighting winter destinations. And the videos focus on Bayfield, Hayward, Wausau, and Green Bay. What is it about these places that make them great winter destinations? Let's talk maybe Bayfield. The video about Bayfield, what is it, a reunion of family, our female friends enjoying a whole bunch of things?
Yeah, you know, one of the wonderful but hard parts about this job is there's just so much to say about Wisconsin. So when we want to take that deep dive and show people what it really looks and feels like to enjoy a destination vacation in Wisconsin, it's really hard to put all that together. It's just a lot to say. So we have several of these. They're called Here's to Being Here. They're under 4 minutes, just quick videos that follow real people doing real things in Wisconsin. So you get a flavor of what it's like to do these things in the different seasons. So we already have some out there for summer and for fall, and now these new ones for winter just hit, and they are so fun.
Oh, yeah.
The one you mentioned for Bayfield, one of my favorites, are all my favorite. But it's girlfriends. It's these group of girlfriends get together, go to Bayfield. They are so silly and ridiculous, but they do some really cool stuff. They take this big machine to get out to the ice caves. They go dog sledding. They actually spend some time at the Wild Rice Retreat, which, talk about hygge, just so relaxing and luxurious there, doing some yoga. And you just get to go with them on their vacation. The one in Wausau is super fun. It's a group of friends that haven't seen each other since college. They try a bunch of craft beers. They make some pottery together. They go to a really fun coffee shop and do a really interesting tasting. And then kind of the main event is they really hit the slopes in Wausau and make the most out of winter. So lots to explore there. This family that goes to the Berkey for the first time, and you can see these kids getting really excited about maybe wanting to take on something like the Berkey in the future. The family has a blast. So I encourage folks to just take a few minutes and go on a little vacation through the Here's to Being Here travel series on travelwisconsin.com.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Another one I would remember is the Green Bay video, because that shows a family visiting Lambeau Field. And go ahead.
Well, it's always, those stories always touch me so much when kids get to go to Lambeau and experience that. It's just, I don't know, just like the fun through their eyes, right? It just really hits. And the family has a great time all through Titletown. They take in some indoor golf, they go ice skating, sledding, and they get to try some indigenous food creations that look spectacular, and then go to the game and see the Hall of Fame, the museum. Like, they just have the best weekend ever. And you can kind of imagine how you could plan that trip for yourself or your family too, be extremely affordable and pack in a ton of fun in a short amount of time.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. And, Green Bay Packers, that's a big draw.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a once in a lifetime. Well, not really. You can do it anytime, but it's a bucket list thing to do. And you can tell, you can see it in the expressions of people who get to do it for the first time, just how special that is.
Yeah. And by the way, you can join in, too, if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience or maybe some event that you want to share. You can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. And, let's take a call. Bob in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to put in a plug for our local ski hill, Tyrol Basin, near Mount Horeb. I started riding a ski bike called a Snow-Go about 7 years ago, and it's really changed my life in winter. It's just so much fun and easy to do. I'd like for people to know, more people to know about it. It's spelled S-N-O-G-O, Snow-Go. And Tyrol is the only place near Madison that allows them. It's kind of like snowboarding was in the 90s. It took a while for it to catch on. But that's what I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, Secretary Sayers, I'm sure you're an expert in Snow-Go.
It's actually new to me, so that's always so exciting when that happens. So it sounds like we can be trying that out at Tyrol, and that's perfect because there's so much else you can do while you're at Tyrol. There's sledding and tubing that you can do there, and there's also lessons that they'll give. So if you're new to the sport, any of these sports, you can get the lessons right there. Plus, it's a great place to be in the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking at some figures, tourism records from 2022 through 2024. I think Wisconsin experienced like a record-setting economic impact from tourism. Does it look like 2025 was another banner year?
Well, you're right. We had three record-breaking years in a row, and we're so proud of that given everything that the tourism industry's been through in recent years. But it just goes to show that people are really prioritizing using their vacation days, spending time with friends and family, making memories. It's really important to people. So we're seeing that. We're really happy they're choosing to spend that time in Wisconsin. You know, as far as 2025 goes, we won't have the numbers for a bit yet. So we're not going to be able to make any projections at this point, but I can say that we had a really, really great year for, we have major events in Wisconsin. Our state fair, Summerfest, EAA set a record this year. So we saw a lot of engagement, enthusiasm for those types of things. Of course, we hosted the NFL draft back in the spring. So we saw a lot of visitors certainly coming through Wisconsin, and I think we'll probably see another good year, but we'll know in June.
Yeah, we'll know in June, but overall, how does the winter tourism in Wisconsin compare to summer tourism? I'm sure there's probably summer tourism draws more people, perhaps not. But what do we know?
I'll admit I was a little bit surprised when I got a chance to dive into the numbers because I assumed that we'd have real peaks and valleys in Wisconsin, and we really don't. And, I shouldn't be surprised because we are a fabulous four-season destination. Of course, our biggest month is July. Our second biggest month is October. But winter does really, really well for Wisconsin. And I think that's because people seek out the kinds of experiences that are really traditionally winter. And we get them reliably in Wisconsin. We have all kinds of cozy cabins to rent, the third most ski hills in the entire country, more children's museums per capita than anywhere else in the country. So there's just so much to see and do in Wisconsin that we see people are prioritizing their winter trips to be here.
And, you know, you think, I'm thinking snowmobiling, I'm thinking downhill skiing, those are big winter sports here. How dependent on snow is winter tourism in Wisconsin?
Well, we certainly love the snow. We love to see that. It's really, really good for those communities that rely on it. And so we promote the heck out of it when it's snowing to make sure that people know where they can find that snow and get out there and enjoy it. But there's been some winters where it's been a little bit low snow. And so that's our opportunity to highlight other things that might be more indoor, even outdoor, but not reliant on the snow, like your fat tire biking or hiking. And even ice events sometimes happen when there's low snow. So what's nice about how things are these days in marketing, a lot of it's digital. We can be pretty nimble and respond to what the weather's doing and drive traffic and awareness to the places where that match, where we know the consumer is looking. So we just do whatever we can to continue to drive economic development through the winter. You don't want to see empty hotels and empty restaurants. You know, you want to see that continuing through the winter. So we do everything we can to keep it going. And it's been going really well because the word's kind of out. Wisconsin's pretty fun in the winter.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about some of the resorts, the ski resorts have been, you know, it's been tough when you get a lack of snow. It you know, hurts their bottom line for sure. So it's great. I think as of last weekend, there was a lot of snow in northern Wisconsin. Of course, less in the southern part of the state. How common is it that people drive north to play in the snow?
Well, I guess I should mention, you know, the ski hills, most of them at this point have ski snowmaking equipment. So it's almost a sure bet that you can get to any of the ski hills and have snow to play in. So that's a really nice thing. That's always there for us in Wisconsin. And the other thing is you can always check the Wisconsin Snow Report. And we actually see in our traffic, this is a report that tells you where the snow is, what the conditions are, what hills are open, what cross-country ski trails are doing. And we find that people are looking at the trail report or the snow report and traveling right to those places where they know the snow is. That's exactly what they're looking for. And it's nice to have this resource available to deliver on that request. So you can find that at travelwisconsin.com/snow report.
Yeah. Ann Sayers, our guest secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. A question for her, or maybe you've got something you want to share about an event or an experience. I hope you'll join in. Number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at winter tourism in our state today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Ann Sayers, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Quick note, tomorrow on the show, it's a Wildlife Wednesday. We'll talk with UW Extension Wildlife Specialist David Drake and Jamie Knack, and then we'll talk about the Sauk Prairie Bald Eagle Watching Days with wildlife biologist Jeb Barzin and the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council board member Jennifer Lenzendorf. So that's tomorrow, but right now, and actually, Bald Eagle Days, that's part of the winter events that you can participate in. And so we'll be reviewing that tomorrow on the show. Again, join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take another call. Dave in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah, thank you. Say, I'm in my mid-70s, but late 20s, early 30s, did a lot of downhill skiing, sometimes Christmas Mountain, Devil's Head, and we would not need to go very far north, like up to Rib Mountain, you know. And I'm just wondering, my daughter's a lifelong Madisonian, but she was in Europe, fell in love with a handsome Italian guy, and they live in Switzerland. And while we were talking over Christmas, we had a nice long talk, but she said something about the number, and it's in the hundreds of small ski resorts in Switzerland that have closed because of global warming. And just wonder how far people have to go now to get ski, because we used to get good cross country by Eagle River, and then towards Traverse City was a little bit better. And also, just wondering how far people have to go now that they didn't have to go 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. Secretary Sayers, comment?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Dave. You know, I can't really speak to how it's changed in recent years or over time, but I can say that our job is to make sure that you know exactly where it is when it happens. And so there's lots of resources available for figuring that out. And you're right. A lot of times it's very close to Madison. Definitely the downhill. You've got, you know, Devil's Head, Cascade, Tyrol, like we talked about, and more. And then we've had excellent cross-country skiing in recent years here in the Madison area as well as up north. So it's just a matter of checking in with that snow report so you have an idea of where the snow line's at and getting out there when the magic happens.
Absolutely. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And that snow report is pretty much right up to date, is it not?
We are so lucky to have volunteers all over the state who are reporting in pretty much real time exactly how things are going. So you can really trust it as a resource of telling you how the conditions are. But the other very cool thing is it'll help you plan your whole trip. It gives you ideas of hotels and lodging nearby, restaurants nearby, other attractions you might want to check out. So you can kind of get on there with your whole travel party and think about how do you want your whole weekend to look and make sure that snow is a part of it.
You know, there's nothing beats to me a cozy winter cabin. You know, where do you look for a weekend cabin rental?
Oh my gosh, we have so many fun ideas for you, and I'm with you on the cozy cabin thing. Very much my jam, hot tea and a book and a good view. Lots of ideas for you. One is Hiller Vacation Homes. They rent cabins, cottages, lakeside homes in places like Eagle River, Minocqua, St. Germain, Three Lakes. And all of these places are going to kind of have their own aesthetic from the modern and the chic to cozy and warm. So it's worth checking that out, Hiller Vacation Homes. One of them is the 6-acre chalet. This is in St. Germain. Totally like that alpine charm. You're just talking about Switzerland. Chalet style cottage. It's completely private. It's on a wooded site. It's not a neighbor in sight. And you're just going to feel like you've stumbled into Switzerland when you spend the night there. So that's one. Another cool one. This is also St. Germain, is the Moonlit Cove. Moonlit Cove, this is a modern masterpiece, soaring great room. It has 3-story high windows facing the lake, towering fireplace, a dining table large enough for a feast. And then I love this. There's a loft overlooking the great room, but that leads into a bedroom and it has its own loft. It's like an inception of lofts.
Its own loft?
Yes. Oh. Lofts with lofts, only in Wisconsin.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, well, that would be a fun place. And repeat where that, because I'm sure people are saying, wait a minute, where was that again?
Hurry, I think it might be booking right now. It's Moonlit Cove. This is in St. Germain. And also, you're going to see the kitchen is stunning. It's like out of a magazine spread. Plus, there's a game room. There's a gazebo and a fire pit. I mean, those are the kinds of memories you can make in winter in Wisconsin that the whole family, you're never going to forget, you know, doing a puzzle or playing games in that kind of retreat space.
Yeah. Well, there are some great winter festivals, too, that I think, you know, if you want to go for a day or two or maybe three, one that intrigued me, and I had to really kind of think about the title of it, was Sylvester Claussen in New Glarus. I think that's how it's pronounced. Sylvester Claussen in New Glarus. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not as familiar. Tell me more.
Well, it's a beer and cheese fest. And I don't know very much more about it. I was hoping you did.
Well, you had me at beer and cheese.
Yeah. I'm going to give you the spelling of this. Sylvester Claussen. I mean, just the spelling, the name alone is going to be something that would be attractive. And New Glarus, of course, is a wonderful city in southwest Wisconsin and a fun place to visit any time of the year.
You know, I'm reading a little bit more about it on the spot here, so. But it's an ancient New Year's celebration from Switzerland. We have kind of a theme going on here. Which, of course, with Nuglaris, that makes a ton of sense. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Coming up January 10th, this Saturday, 2 to 8.
Oh. And then there's a beer. I was mentioning beer and cheese. And there's a beer and cheese fest in Madison. And that's coming up pretty quickly, too. I think it's January 17th, if I'm not mistaken. And I've participated in that one. And it's a lot of fun because there are all kinds of cheeses and they're paired. It's indoors. It's at the Alliant Energy Center.
That looks like that's coming up January 17th.
And you can pair some beers with some cheeses there. And I like that idea. Then there's, oh my gosh, the Winterfest in Wausau. That's coming up January 24th.
Yeah, we've got Schnee Days coming up at Elkhart Lake. That's January 23rd to the 25th. This is where you get to show off your cooking skills with some chili cook-off. You can shake off the cabin fever with some fun runs. And then they've got all kinds of other things. Cocoa and crafting, dog sledding demonstrations, ice skating. Elkhart Lake's always a fun time.
And I'll tell you another one that I visited more than once is the U.S. Snow Sculpting Championship and Winterfest at Lake Geneva, and I'm not sure of the date on that, or the dates on that. It's over several days, but the snow sculpting is unbelievable. It's the U.S. championship.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, it's truly mind-blowing talent on display for that event.
Yeah, I love it. I love going there. Although it can be a little bit cold outside, but you know what? I found a lot of places inside where I could have some enjoyment too. There's some restaurants and bars that are in Lake Geneva area that are a whole lot of fun as well. And then we get into February, and there's Sturgeon Spectacular in Fond du Lac.
Oh yeah, I went to that last year. So much fun! Such a great celebration of our largest inland lake there.
Yeah, we got snow sculpting there too, but there's curling and there's a horse-drawn carriage that you can get a ride on if you want. And then I think in February too, it's a two-day Winterfest at Winter Festival in Cedarburg. And that one kind of appeals to me because there's an Iceborg Open Golf Tournament. So you're playing a round of golf or in a tournament on the lake.
Oh my gosh, how fun would that be?
I've got some ice bug shoes that you can walk on the ice, and you can twist and do whatever you want, and you're not going to fall over.
That seems like a very good idea. Safety first, Larry.
That's when I might, Joel's let me know, you probably need orange golf balls or some other colored golf ball. White ones wouldn't work very well. Oh, man. And that, you know, we didn't talk about the indoor facilities much. You did mention them, but there are a lot of them geared to visitors in Wisconsin. We got the Building for Kids Children's Center in Appleton, among the Fox Cities Children's Museum. I've been there. It's a great museum. And Anne, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us to promote some Wisconsin activities in winter. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy your winter.
Thanks, Anne Sayers. Always fun to talk with her, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. I want to thank you very much for listening today. We've had three topics, and all those shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Padnod, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, Jill Nadeau, who is a participant and also our executive director. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.